2005 Committee on Wheels. We're a little short-handed this morning. Hopefully some of our members will get here, but I'm going to go ahead and open a hearing on this most fascinating measure, SJR 7, and ask the committee administrator to tell us a little bit about the measure and ask Senators Johnson and Morris to come on forward while the committee administrator is giving us some information.
Thank you, Madam Chair. SJR 7 proposes an amendment to the Oregon Constitution that would require ballot measure initiatives qualifying for the ballot to be submitted to the legislature on the first day of the legislative session. Following that, both houses of the legislature would hold hearings, make findings, and conduct an advisory vote on the ballot measure initiative, after which time the ballot measure initiative would appear on the ballot at the general election.
Great. Welcome, the two of you. I'm hoping we'll have committee members trickle in. This measure is extremely fascinating. As we were talking, what's most fascinating is the fact that we would have a legislative history that would help any judicial interpretation in the event there is the initiative does pass. So please proceed.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Frank Morris, State Senator from District 8. Representing Albany and Corvallis. Good morning, and thank you for this opportunity to appear. This proposed resolution is really very straightforward, and the intent is to develop a more thoughtful process, the initiative process. It is not an attempt to deny the right of redress through the initiative process of citizens in the state of Oregon. What it is, it's an attempt to be more informed, quite frankly. The initiative process as it exists today is largely, once it qualifies for the ballot, the initiative process goes into your, at best, 30-second sound bites, most often 5-second sound bites. And this would be a process that would allow people to be more informed by having the legislature take a very thoughtful review, go through our hearings processes. And by the way, as a new member of the Assembly, I do have a great respect for the hearing process and listening to people, taking it through legislative revenue, legislative fiscal, understanding the consequences intended or otherwise, and then having this body take a position and vote. Each side of the Assembly would be recorded in the voter's pamphlet with a statement, findings of fact, and I believe that that would be a helpful process for the voters to better understand what they're voting on. I have passed out to you what I've tried to characterize the impacts of the cumulative impacts of voter initiatives in the 90s. And as we all know, there have been many. And if you look at 1990, we call this On the Oregon Trail. We've had a general fund, and we had a lottery fund, but by the way, it was not discretionary at that time. We had a general fund. We had the three broad categories of expenditures of public safety, public education, and health care. And as you can see, at that time, the buggy really was pretty full. And then if you go to 2005, I would call this the populist wagon on the Oregon Trail. The general fund and the lottery fund are really struggling to support the initiatives that voters have placed upon these funds. A good example is the study that we asked Legislative Revenue to do to look at the impacts from the 89-91 biennium to this present biennium. And spending per capita, and these are adjusted for inflation, the spending per capita in the 89-91 biennium was $1,625 per capita. If you come forward, adjust it for inflation, adjust it for the initiatives, that we're now spending $1,453 per capita. So what the initiatives have done, they have placed a burden on this very discrete source of revenues in a way that has impinged upon our ability to continue to support what we did in the same ratio in 1990. Now, I believe that if we can somehow have a more thoughtful process, not deny people the right of redress, but to shine a bright light on it so that we really truly understand what we're doing to our state, that it would be helpful. Incidentally, this is not a bill that is pointing to any one particular political ideology or persuasion or philosophy. It really addresses all sides of the spectrum, because if you look at the initiative process, it has been utilized by special interests, whether you're from one side of the pole or the other side. And I believe we need a more thoughtful process. The other piece of information that I have provided to you is it's called the Oregon Fiscal Policy Benchmarks to Western States as expressed in allocations of general fund expenditures. What we did in my office is to try to understand how we compare to our Western states with respect to the policies that we have set in motion, by and large, through the initiative process, in how we allocate our discretionary monies. And the information that we found was really quite alarming. The question, I think, to consider is, why is Oregon's allocation to public safety 84% higher than the average of the other Western states? And if you look at, and I would have, before we did this analysis, I would have bet a small sum of money that in our human services side that we were high. We're not. We're low. I wouldn't want you to read too much into this data, because what it is, it's just a benchmark as to how we allocate our discretionary monies, general fund and lottery, compared to how other states allocate their discretionary monies. What you're seeing here, I believe, is the impact of initiatives on this process. I think it raises some very legitimate policy questions, at least from this point carrying forward. But I think it's illustrative of how the initiative process can impact our general funds. So with that, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I would defer to my colleague, Senator Johnson, for her comments as well.
Senator Morris, this cartoon, did you have someone draw it? Or?
Yes.
Okay, all right.
Yes.
It's very well done.
Thank you. It's a cartoon that was done by a lady from Western Oregon University. And I have used this in, I have created this visual mental metaphor in quite a number of speeches in talking about how initiatives have impacted us and the place that they put us today in trying to find resources for all of the programs that we have requirements to fund. And it's very difficult. It's exceedingly difficult. And people kind of get the idea of this kind of a metaphor. We have truly burdened our general fund, lottery fund revenues in ways that have tied our hands. In fact, I would suggest to you also that Paul Warner's findings that nearly a third of our general fund budget today are committed by voter initiatives.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Betsy Johnson. I'm the state senator from Senate District 16. I really have nothing to add to my good colleague, Senator Morris. I'm here in complete support of this bill. I'm one of the co-sponsors on the bill. When Senator Morris first approached me with the idea, it was immediately obvious the problem that he was addressing in the legislation that he proposed, and I was pleased to be able to add my support to it. It would be redundant to restate what Senator Morris has already said. I wish to be associated with his remarks as the rationale for the legislation, and I'm here in support of SJR 7.
Great. Thanks. Question for the panel. Senator Ferriello.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Madam Chairman, I have asked several questions. We've had discussions. Senator Morris and I have gone around and around on this issue, and I don't support this legislation, and I'd just like to ask some questions for the record.
Feel free, Senator Ferriello.
I'd like to hear from either of the panelists whether or not they think a legislative advisory or a legislative analysis would have changed the outcome of any of the initiatives.
Well, that's an impossible question to answer, but I believe that information is a good thing. And the information that is generated by special interests on either side of an issue, maybe not as objective as it can be. When I've seen the hearings process work here, where you change people's perceptions by information. And presently, as it exists, the information resides in the special interests and how they choose to characterize it. If it comes here through the hearings process, you have a full legislative staff to review it. We take an advisory position. I've spoken to many people in my district, and they've said, boy, if you could do that, that would be great. Instead of having to wade through the initiative, if they could look and see how their representative or senator had voted, how collectively we had voted, how we had looked at the intended consequences, the unintended consequences. We're talking about very serious issues here. When we're amending the Constitution of our state, and we don't even take the process, we don't even have a process, a thoughtful process, to review what's happening, I think it's a tragedy, personally. And information is good. What this would do, the only thing that this would do that would be negative is would slow the process down, because the petitions would, as you can read the bill, they would have to be filed at least 6 months prior to the regular session, regular scheduled session. We would hold the hearings, have advisory opinions, would then go into the voter's pamphlet for the next regularly scheduled general election, unless we choose to accelerate it, and we could do that. So, Madam Chair, Senator Farrelly, I think information is a good thing, and to deny that opportunity, I think, is wrong, quite frankly.
Hang on just a minute. Senator Johnson?
Madam Chair, Senator Farrelly, I would only add that in this building, you would provide a forum for discussion outside of the very expensive ground war established by proponents and opponents of ballot measures. I still hold on to the belief very firmly that this is a citizen legislature where citizens can come in and address policymakers in a way that they might not otherwise be heard absent fact check books in a ballot measure debate. And so I agree with my colleague Senator Morris in his observation that information is good, and I think in this venue ordinary citizens could come in and weigh in on the pros and cons of a ballot measure. The other point that the chair made perhaps before you arrived, Senator Farrelly, was that the opportunity to build a legislative history that would help with judicial interpretation should a ballot measure pass, I think contributes to the record.
And I think, Senator Johnson, that's a really good point, particularly with regards to ballot measure 37. I don't know whether the legislature having a conversation on that ballot measure would have changed the outcome, but at least we would have had some clear discussion about the quagmire of legal issues that ballot measure 37 is now is bringing before us. And I think at least we would have a better sense about what was the intent of the craft of ballot measure 37, and as today we have no clue, and I think it leads to numerous legal questions.
Madam Chair, Senator Farrelly, I agree with the Chair's observations. I think the other thing that many of us have watched with increasing alarm is the amount of money that goes into ballot measure debates on either side. And in order to create a forum for those without adequate means to, say, even buy a page in the voter's pamphlet, I think it is incumbent upon us to create a neutral forum where those persons' opinion is as welcome as persons' advocating or opposing with the financial means to take their story to the streets.
Great. Senator Farrelly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess what I heard was that it would not be determinable whether or not any of this analysis would make any difference in any of the initiatives.
Well, I'll take a crack at that. I believe it could be. It is very possible that it could be. You know, I've come to this assembly with some rather at times rigid ideas, only to find that information changes those positions. I mean, that's part of the process. As you become better informed, then you can make wiser decisions. And that's very simply what this would do.
Madam Chair, follow-up.
Senator Farrier.
So it might change the outcomes. Madam Chair, let me proceed. The issue for me is, it's my impression, and I think the impression of a lot of people, that the initiative process is a right that the people hold, that they exercise freely, in an unfettered manner, that the legislature's reputation and the citizens' level of trust in the legislature is not something that I would say is persuasive. So we basically offer a prior restraint to the citizens' right to access the initiative process, slow the process down, spin it, package it, put it in the voters' pamphlet in some unspecified manner, and I suppose the ostensible objective is to somehow change the outcome, because frankly we don't like the outcomes. So I guess what I see is that the bill purports to be a good public policy, when I think what it really does is it impinges on the citizens' right of pursuing the initiative process, which is a right of the people in the Constitution that's equal to the right of legislators to legislate, or the judiciary to adjudicate, or the executive officer to pontificate. But I don't know that it's the legislator's business to insinuate themselves into that process. And if in fact legislators want to provide information, nothing stops us from contacting the legislative fiscal office and writing them a letter to conduct an analysis on a proposed initiative and publishing that in the voters pamphlet. Nothing stops us from asking the legislative council about the constitutionality of an issue. And in fact, when those opinions are received by legislators, we're free to use them, publish them, or put them in a drawer. So there are ways for the legislator to interact with the initiative process without insinuating themselves directly in the process, which I believe Oregonians think is a sacred right. And if this were a bill that would actually add something to the process, I'd like to know what other than information it would add to the process. And so far I've heard it's about information. Well, we live in an information age. I think there's other alternatives to allow information that deals with the very issues of effect and cost analysis. And the only thing that I think that is different about this bill is it somehow offers a referendum process where legislators would vote on an initiative. And to me, that undermines the whole purpose of an initiative, which is to allow the people to have a voice in the legislative process and to take a vote and to instruct their legislators. So if you could address how it is that we keep the integrity of the initiative process, and or how insinuating legislators for an advisory vote honors the initiative process, that's what I'd like to hear about.
Well, Senator Morrison, before you respond to that question, my recollection is that Washington State has a similar process to this, and I could be wrong, but that my sense is that this has not stopped initiatives from going forward in Washington. I don't know. I don't know if there are other states that have a similar process to this that you're suggesting.
Madam Chair, Senator Farrelly, I have heard also, I have not done the investigation to see what the state of Washington does. This bill does not change the right of redress, not one iota, in terms of gathering signatures, qualifying for the ballot, and referring to the voters. It does not change it one iota. What it does is it just by the very nature of coming here, it would slow the process down. Is that a bad thing when we're talking about amending the Constitution of the state of Oregon? I don't think so. One thing that it does accomplish here is that everything we do has a very bright light shown upon it. The press is here regularly, day in, day out, night, day, and what we do gets free press, quite frankly. And what we're doing is is communicated to people. They have the opportunity to inform themselves in newspapers and television. If an initiative qualified it came here, it would be a very high-profile thing. And we would have the opportunity, both the House would vote, that would be recorded. The Senate would vote, that would be recorded. Only advisory. And the other issue, Senator, as a new member to this process, I came to the legislature with some preconceptions about this body that, quite frankly, were negative, carrying the same weight of cynicism that the public has, and as you have expressed, Senator, about this body. I don't feel that way. I hold this body in very, very high regard. We are representative of the state of Oregon. We may not agree, but we are indeed representative of all the persuasions, and those voices have a right to be heard, and they are heard here. It's an amazing process, and I hold it in the highest regard. And quite frankly, I believe the initiative process, unfettered, really undermines representative government. Now, having said that, I believe that all people have a right of redress when this body will not address issues, and particularly in the way of land use reform. That's a classic example that's before us right now. But I don't hold your view, Senator Perioli, with respect to this body and its role in setting the public policy of our state. I think we have. I think it's incumbent upon us to exercise leadership, and sometimes we abdicate that to the people and to the talk shows and 30-second sound bites. And I think that when we abdicate that responsibility, I think we have truly denigrated representative government.
Thank you. Sam Morris, just a couple follow-ups to that. Wouldn't also by having the legislature discuss these proposed ballot measures, wouldn't that give citizens an opportunity to weigh in and maybe change the course of debate, which, frankly, isn't allowed during the initiative process? I mean, people can vote yes or no, but they can't change the outcome. Wouldn't having citizens be involved in the legislative process enable us to hear from citizens how they feel and then possibly change the course of the initiative because of that citizen input?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we would certainly reserve the right to hold hearings in any number or form or across the state on these issues as they come before us through the initiative process. And it wouldn't preclude us from actually taking the subject matter and running a parallel initiative, or not initiative, referral to the voters out of this body. That, you know, that initiative could be the impact or have the force upon this body to more thoughtfully consider the issue.
It would enable us to be proactive after hearing from citizens.
Yes, we could be proactive.
Senator Johnson, did you wish to?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess what I'm struggling with is the issues raised by our good colleague from Eastern Oregon in terms of doing anything that changes the process. I believe that the Rules Committee, and I am embarrassed to say that I don't know how you voted, Senator Ferriero, may have moved out a bill to cause there to be proportional number of signatures gathered from congressional districts. That, in my opinion, would be a mechanism to make sure that Eastern Oregon and Central Oregon had the same voice in this process that Multnomah County or Lane County had. And if the objection is doing anything that changes the initiative process, I'm trying to tease out what the objection is in having a wider forum to do these discussions. Is it doing anything that adjusts the process, or is it simply the contents of this bill?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Senator Johnson asks an excellent question. Let me answer it in two ways. First of all, I did help sponsor an initiative that would have elected judges by district. That was aimed exactly at breaking up the cartel of judicial appointments that happens along the I-5 corridor, particularly where there are communities that have law schools. And it's not inconceivable that people of association and experience that shared, who grow up together sort of in a community, trust each other. So I don't see necessarily that there's anything sinister in that, but it does tend to deny people that live in rural communities, particularly Eastern Oregon, access to the bench for appointments. That, I dare say, would never have emerged from this building, or would have come out of this building with an advisory vote that reflects the population distribution and the urban-rural divide. I think it would be almost impossible for that to have moved forward on its merits. So I would tell you that there are, in fact, circumstances that were just described to us. Senator Moore said, well, maybe the legislature could launch a competing effort on the initiative. So that's exactly what I'm worried about, messing about with the system that is supposed to be available to citizens. That's sort of the first issue. The second issue for me is that the initiative process, I wonder how this measure would fare if it were referred to the people for a vote. Could you hazard an opinion, both of you?
Madam Chair, Senator Perry, I have not done any polling with respect to this issue, so it would be just a wild guess. But I think people at this point in time, I think would be receptive to making a more thoughtful process.
Do it.
So, you know, we're not the ones deciding this. We're giving voters the opportunity to create a more thoughtful process.
Senator Morrison, gets the and Senator Ferrioli, I guess the conversation about the judges being elected from judicial districts, while you state that might not be able to come out of the legislature, it was this body, I believe, who did refer the measure that Senator Johnson referred to earlier, requiring initiatives to have reflecting signatures from congressional districts. I believe the former Speaker of the House, Lynn Lundquist, passed that measure to the Senate. It went through the Senate, and the voters then rejected it. But I do think this body has been fairly aware in its voting of the needs of smaller communities, rural communities, over the last 10 years. Maybe I'm wrong, but I think we've done a pretty good job meeting the needs of rural communities in terms of the initiative and elections process. So, Senator Ferrioli, anything further?
Only that I think this is sort of a case study in how people view the democratic process and how they view the initiative process in comparison with the legislative process, the judicial process, and the executive process. And I tend to see the initiative process as a co-equal process. I wouldn't expect to impose a prior restraint on the executive. I wouldn't expect to propose a prior restraint on the judicial. And I wouldn't accept a prior restraint on the legislative. So how could I support a prior restraint on the initiative process?
Senator Morris.
I would like to make a comment with respect to populist budgeting. The question is, does it work? Today, in the situation in which we find ourselves, does populist budgeting work? Not very well. And that is where we find ourselves. The cumulative effect of all of these initiatives in tying our hands to be responsive to change is very difficult. And that's the intent of this little cartoon, is to make that point. And when you have initiatives that run with indeterminate fiscal consequences, somebody needs to be taking a very thoughtful review of what we're doing. And that's what I'm asking this body to do, is to refer to the voters of the state of Oregon the opportunity to be more thoughtful and to understand that when they vote for something, it has fiscal consequences, and allow us to do our job advising them of the importance and the weight of their votes. And I don't see that this in any way denigrates the role of citizen elections for issues that they find to be important, that for whatever reason this body has chosen to ignore.
Thank you, Senator Morris. Senator Shields.
Senator Morris, I'm going to ask you, you've spoken on this issue publicly more than than most. I want you to tell me whether I would be accurate or inaccurate in what I'm about to describe. I came into this body shortly after 1990. I was elected in 92. My first session was 93. Ballot measure 5 passed just as I was arriving. When I arrived, the state was putting 30% into schools, local taxes 70%, and now it's just reversed. No new money was brought to the equation. Okay. A few years later, ballot measure 11 arrived. It started a building boom in the prison industry. What I'm wondering is, it's just a gut feeling for me. I'm listening to my tummy. I don't think that the voters really understood that we would end up with the rest of this equation over here, with putting less into social services, 22% lower than the average for the rest of Western states. You know, I don't think they ever intended to pull money away from social services to put it to education to cover this unfunded quote-unquote mandate that was put on the state. Okay? I just don't believe that they thought it through that far. Likewise, I don't believe that they thought ballot measure 11 through that far. But you're the one that's talked to people. Have you had scenarios where little light bulbs go on in conversation with people around subjects like 5 or 11 being heaped on top of the wagon? Have people confirmed my suspicion in your conversations?
Not sure. Senator Shields, I don't believe that, again, populist budgeting allows people to make informed choices. And that's what we do here, is budgeting is a matter of balancing. If you're going to mandate something that has a very, very high fiscal consequence, and at the same time the voters say we're not going to increase taxes to provide more revenues, something has to change. We can't do it all. And that's the point of this. And I think people are becoming very aware of the cumulative impacts of what unfunded voter initiatives have placed on this state. Under the present system, it doesn't lend itself well to making balanced choices between, if I want to fund more prisons, it means I'm going to fund something else less. And I think the work that Paul Warner did was incredible in shedding a light on this issue, because the claim from outside this building, generally perceived, is that this body has been out of control in spending. But when you factor in, no, I've really baited Senator Farrell with this issue.
I'm sure you have, Senator Morris.
but when you factor in the unfunded voter initiatives and balance it for inflation, in 89-91 we were spending $625 per capita. Today we're spending $1,453 per capita. But what has changed with respect to 1990 on this cartoon for public safety, human services, and education? Those all exist today in the same way they existed in 1990. But we've just burdened through the initiative process. So I think people are ready to be more thoughtful in what they do.
Have you done the calculations on the $1,400 versus the $600? What percentage of that was due to ballot measures?
100%. The difference between $1,625 and $1,453 is 100% unfunded voter initiatives.
So it wasn't due to an out-of-control legislative spending or a Democratic governor who couldn't... didn't know how to balance a checkbook.
Well, I don't know about all of the issues.
Don't put words in his mouth.
Actually,
but clearly,
Republicans were
clearly,
during that period.
Oh, they were? I didn't know, Senator Farrielly.
Clearly, voter initiatives have impacted this state in a very serious way. Now, is that to say that the voter initiatives were wrong? No, not necessarily. What it says is that you can't budget thoughtfully through the initiative process. It's impossible. And at least if it comes here and we have an opportunity to look at it and to study it and hold hearings and listen to the constituents and then refer to the voters with a very informed recommendation, which I think my voters have a right, my constituents have a right to know how I voted on that initiative and my position on it. And I think that's exercising leadership. And I believe it's incumbent upon us to figure out how we can provide that leadership and create a more informed populist vote.
Senator Shields?
I appreciate what you're saying. I really do. You talked about shedding light on things. As you've been talking about this concept, who are the people that are most against it?
Madam Chair, Senator Shields, those people that have special interests, and it's both sides of the equation, because if you look at the, you know, you look at this bundle that we're carrying right now, it addresses the wide spectrum of political persuasion. It's the special interests that would probably not be in favor of Senator Farrelly kind of messing in their nest a little bit by slowing the process down. That's all we do. We would just slow it down. We don't change anything other than slowing it down and bringing it here. And that we're asking the voters for that opportunity, giving them the opportunity to determine whether it's worthwhile for our advisory investigation.
Senator Shields.
Just a final question. I keep going back to ballot measure 5 because I was a freshman when it hit here and was watching that transfer of dollars from human services to education and so on over the years. And it was incremental. It was about 10%. You know, out in the public, they said the budget's out of control. We're expanding by 17% per year. And I started saying, wait a minute, let's remove ballot measure 5. Let's remove ballot measure 11 from the equation. And that 17% shrunk down immensely. And it's some of the same thing that you're talking about. I'm asking you to think a minute and to... I guess I'm asking a complicated question, but if this had been in place when ballot measure 5 was proposed and we had had hearings like you propose in this constitutional amendment, do you think that ballot measure 5 could have been amended, for instance, to address the question of how you fund it? If it's not going to be local property taxes, how should it be funded? Do you envision a process where you could actually take a ballot measure and amend it? Or maybe you have a dual course where you have an unamended version, since that's what the folks put out there, and then have a kind of an amended ballot measure as well? Do you envision that if shedding light on things makes a difference?
Madam Chair, Senator Shields, I agree with Senator Farrelly. I don't think that we in any way should have the right to change an initiative as it has been proposed and approved by the Secretary of State. I don't think we have that right. I don't think we should try to have that right. But on the other hand, when something, if it carries enough importance that they get the signatures and then they qualify for the ballot, I have heard so many times in this building what are we going to do with Don McIntyre's population inflation initiative? I mean, there is a tremendous weight behind that, and the citizens deserve that right to push us in ways that maybe we're not comfortable in going. And absent the initiative process, maybe we wouldn't go there. But at the same time, once that ballot measure is qualified, it could provide an impetus for example, let's take Measure 37. Measure 37 is not a good statute. But what it is, it's something that is moving this body to doing something that they wouldn't do otherwise. And had that come before this body in a regular session where you had the full length of the session to craft thoughtful, workable land use reform, then maybe you could exercise, we collectively could exercise our responsibility and then refer something to the voters that's more thoughtfully crafted.
Or, Senator Morris, couldn't you also make statutory changes without the need for, let's say ballot measure 37 had come to us before last session. Don't you think that serves as sort of a wake-up call to the legislature, and maybe folks on both sides, frankly, would have been more willing to make substantial changes to the land use system, therefore maybe obliterating the need for the passage of the measure itself? I don't know. Occurred to me.
Well, Madam Chair, I think we give it a chance.
Okay.
I think we give it a chance.
I would only add to my colleague's comments that it has been my observation in town halls and talking with folks that most people seem oblivious to the fiscal consequences of initiatives. I'm waiting for the one that mandates universal health care or some kind of access to health care loaded onto the general fund that takes up every last remaining available dime. When you see the ballot measure and the idea is should everyone have access to health care, great idea, but people have not put as fine a point on the fiscal consequences. If this legislation does nothing more than to provide a forum to fine-tune the fiscal consequences, I think it will have made a substantial contribution.
Thank you. Did you have another question, Senator?
Yeah, it's not a question. I guess it's that I look at the list of folks that have engaged in the initiative process, and I think you could characterize some of them as special interests. I think it'd be very unwise to characterize crime victims in that regard. And I do acknowledge the fact that a lot of our spending has been directed by Oregonians through the initiative process. That's a fact. And I don't like all of them, to tell you the truth. Some of the mandates that are put on us by initiative, I'm uncomfortable with. But this bill seems to me about not liking outcomes, not liking the outcome, and wanting to somehow create a process that changes the outcome. And I really believe that it's unwise of us to insinuate ourselves as the legislature into the initiative process with the idea of changing the outcome. It's the citizens' right. And so that is the place where I sort of bunch up about the idea. I believe that there is analysis that can be done in the legislature. I believe that legislative fiscal and legislative revenue could be induced in some way to put arguments for and arguments against in the voter's pamphlet. What I strenuously object to is a prior restraint that slows the process down, and what I strenuously object to is the referendum process where legislators presume to tell Oregon voters how they should think and how they should vote. So I would really think that the flaws in this process are having the legislature take some kind of official position on an initiative before the citizens have had a chance to make up their minds.
Senator Johnson, did you wish to respond?
No, Madam Chair. Okay. The only comment I was going to make is in response to the thought about changing outcomes. I would probably respectfully disagree. Outcomes haven't occurred. This is the legislature weighing in prior to the outcome to inform the outcome, and that would be the only comment I'd have.
Thank you, Senator Johnson. Senator Morris, I guess I think it's interesting, this conversation, Senator Morris, that you raised about the fact that it's really been the initiative process driving the growing cost of government. And I think in light of that, conversations about a spending cap and words that I've heard my colleagues say about government spending out of control is really not accurate, then, according to the information you provide us this morning. The real accurate information is that in terms of the spending, it's Oregon initiative, the costs are really increasing the growth of government. Isn't that correct?
Madam Chair, it's a huge factor. We have a very complex budget. Between our discretionary funds or other funds, fees, fines, assessments, and federal funds. And there's something in that equation for every side of the political spectrum to hang their hat on. We're high spending, according to Paul Warner's, the report that he submitted to us. You know, we're 11th in this nation per capita in spending. We're fourth in the nation in accessing federal funds per capita. We're 46th in total, what I would call involuntary taxes, personal income, property taxes. And when he wrapped all those things up together, we're 35th. So, there's something for everybody in this equation. But what has happened is, quite frankly, is in looking back, is we had the decade of the 90s was the decade of initiatives. Those impacts have been largely masked by an economy that was exploding and generating revenues to where it, you all made it work, those of you that were in the assembly at that time. Today, it doesn't work. We have a structural deficit today. And how we deal with that is before us, because clearly the revenues will not support all of the expectations that have been placed upon us. The impact of voter initiatives is huge. We are always called to be accountable, and as representatives of our state, that's legitimate, accountability. But it's a two-way street. Voters also need to be held accountable for the actions that they have taken. And this is not in any way, in any manner, disrespectful of voters. But, we collectively in the state need to understand where we are today, why we're here, how we got there, and what can we do in the future that makes this process more thoughtful, more informative, and allows us to create the best policy for the state of Oregon possible.
Thank you both very much.
Appreciate you
coming before us today.
Madam Chairman.
Senator Farrioli.
Thank you for this debate, and I want to thank the proponents. It's very interesting and very stimulating, and they made excellent points.
Thank you.
With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on SJR 7. Ms. Eaton will bring you up shortly, but I have Senator Cruz waiting to testify on Senate Bill 606. I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 606 and ask the committee administrator to tell us briefly what this measure does.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 606 establishes a system of voluntary electronic campaign contribution and expenditure reporting. It allows candidates and political committees to file contribution and expenditure disclosure statements electronically using software provided or approved by the Secretary of State. It also eliminates the requirement that the occupation of a campaign contributor be reported.
Thank you. Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Senator Jeff Cruz, Senate District 1. If it's not too inappropriate, I appreciated the discussion that just went on here. I have some things. When it comes back, I would like to be informed, because I think there are some other things, other perspectives on there. So, but to the bill at hand. You know, as we mess with campaigns and campaign finances, and clearly there have been issues this session in that universe, and we attempt to restrict this or restrict that or confine this or confine that, I think what we've seen over time is that if you try to put something in a box, it will find a way out of that box. And so I think no matter what we attempt to do, somebody's going to find a way to game the system. So from my perspective, I think true campaign finance reform is quite simply the public having access and almost instantaneous access to any activity going on in the campaign. And, you know, rather than restrict who we can take money from or who can contribute or what the money could be spent for, if the public knows who the contributors are, if the public knows what the expenditures are, I think that is shining the bright light on the process that is going to make people accountable simply because there's no place to hide anything. And as I've spent the last decade wrestling with the system we have, and you know, for probably my first three times I ran, I was my own campaign finance chairman, and it seemed I could never do a report quite right, and so I'd always have to adjust it because I would put fill in the wrong box or whatever I would do, and I wondered why that was necessary, and what it came down to was there is software available, there are programs available that would allow a candidate to simply, having this program in his possession and the Secretary of State having the same program, for him to input data of what he spent money on, he or she spent money on, and who contributed to their campaign in whatever form. And that program can do the aggregate compilations, and so all the candidate needs to do is submit the raw data. And that would be instantly, you know, I put down in here once a week because you shouldn't have to do it every day. That's a bit time consuming, but once a week. And and it would be instantly accessible to the public, and so we would know over time what was happening. Now, the system we have now, where you have reporting periods, it's possible to game that system, and you know, you get down to the last reporting period before the election, and you don't actually make those expenditures so they don't have to show up till after the election and things like that. So, you know, and that's all well and fine. It's a system we have now. But it appears to me that if we want transparency in the way government operates and the way campaigns operate, that this would be a way to get there. Now, there would be a cost to this, and we understand that, and I think it would be fully appropriate for the candidate or the committee to have to purchase the software from the Secretary of State. And I don't think that cost would be very high. Now, this is a rough bill at this point in time. It clearly needs some detail added to it and a few other things. But the concept is, Madam Chair, that instant reporting is campaign finance reform. It eliminates all of the ways that we and PACs game the system. And so from my perspective, I would have no problem at any point in time with somebody knowing who is contributing to my campaign and how I was spending the money. And if we're trying to get to accountability and we're trying to do something to gain people's trust in the political process, I think this would go a long ways to achieving that. I think it's an idea that has merit. We'd certainly be willing to work with Secretary of State's office on this issue, but you know, one of the things that we have to do in this process at this point in time is try to regain public trust, and having transparency in the election process, I think, would go a long ways towards doing that. Do you want to answer any questions?
Thank you, Senator Cruz. I have a couple, but first I want to introduce, I understand we have a class or a group of students from Oregon Episcopal High School. Welcome, and I hope you enjoy your day at the Capitol. So thanks for coming today. Senator Cruz, one of the questions I wrote when you first started testifying is why do you think the public should have access to our contribution and expense information on a regular basis once a week? Your response would be to regain public trust? You think that's important?
Madam Chair, I think, and from the perspective of somebody running for office, we get labeled as being in the back pocket of this interest group or that interest group. That kind of gets put to rest by either you are or you're not, because people can go right to the website and see, who your contributors are. I mean, if your contributors are X or Y, it's going to be there and it's going to be apparent. I just think, rather than to say you can only take X amount, I mean, if company Y contributes $50,000 to a campaign, it would surely show that there is a vested interest by that candidate, and the public should be able to be aware of that. And on the other hand, if the candidate doesn't want to be put in that box, that would restrain them from probably going there. So, you can do some things after the last pre-election reporting period that don't show up till after the election's over, and so there is ways currently to game the system, and this would eliminate the ability to do that, Madam Chair, to a large degree. I mean, clearly nothing's perfect, and whatever we create, there's probably ways to circle around it. But I think I'm a linear person, and I think sometimes being simpler is better, and this is a simpler and more direct approach.
Okay. In terms of simplicity, do you perceive difficulties for either treasurers or candidates themselves on having to report on a weekly basis? Do you think that will be difficult for candidates or not?
Talking to the person who's been doing my CNEs, once I discovered that I
could hire someone to do
hire somebody, because then I'm not having to do amendments, and it was very nice. But it wouldn't be, because they're doing that recording now, and it would require, to a degree, of the candidates a little more due diligence to not just let things sit and kind of do them in a bunch, but from the I want to get away from these big blocks of time that we aggregate and have something that's more immediate and more direct, and if indeed, electronic filing is already happening now, so if indeed all it is a matter of inputting data, it's really not going to be that difficult.
Okay. So given your promises that you want to regain public trust and that this method is not too difficult for the candidates or the treasurers, the way the bill is structured is the candidate has a choice to either pursue this route or continue filing CNE statements. Why not make it mandatory and have the candidate require all candidates to file on a regular basis?
Madam Chair, I'd have no problem with that. The reason I put the flexibility in is I'm assuming an initial front-end cost to the candidate to go to this system. The software is not going to be free. And what I did not want to do was, we have people that decide to run for office and are doing it on a shoestring. And I did not want to put an artificial financial barrier in front of them. Now, clearly anybody that survives a primary cycle and is running for general would probably have the resources to do it. So maybe we bifurcate from that perspective, but what I did not want to do was put any artificial constraints in front of somebody in the neighborhood who decided they wanted to run for office and their friends are supporting them, and they're going to rise above the, I think it's $2,500 barrier, and then immediately impose a $500 cost on them, for example.
Okay.
So,
thank you. I appreciate that. Senator Farioli.
Thank you, Madam Chairman.
just to share the senator's pain on the issue of reporting, I've been fortunate enough to be able to hoodwink CPAs into doing my CNEs during the entire period I've been in public office, which has been very nice for me because the rules are very complicated. And I had to purchase software for the CPA to use to interface with the state system. So I'm not even sure that the cost that's being identified as an additional cost is really an extra cost. I'm certain if we extend the reporting requirement to any candidate, then certainly those that have run traditionally for offices like the county commission and the city council will sort of have flown below the radar on the thresholds of reporting. And it might be a disproportional percentage cost for them to do public reporting. But I think anybody that runs for a state office certainly is going to have to either find somebody who is doing these reports on a fee basis, in which case they're already paying for the software embedded in the fee, or convince some volunteer to do it, in which case the costs are direct. But I would tend to think that having the issue of disclosure and the ease of reporting as features would add transparency and could only improve the system.
So. Madam Chair, Senator Ferrioli, a couple points. Number one, this is dealing with people who file CNEs with Secretary of State, so it wouldn't be local elections because they don't file with Secretary of State. And the other point would be there is an electronic filing system now, but this would be a different system from what's in place, because what the Secretary of State would have to have would be the program that would do the aggregating, and, you know, so all the candidate was having to do was file contributions and expenditures, and they would flow into that report. What we have now is we do the aggregating and then file it. So it would be a slightly different system, but it would also eliminate errors. So because they would all be in the program, and that program does exist currently, so it is doable.
Thank you. Senator
Ferrioli?
No, that's right. Okay, great. Thanks, Senator Cruz.
Thank you very much.
Ms. Andy Miller, come on up.
Thank you, Chair Brown, Senator Ferrioli. For the record, my name is Andy Miller. I'm the director of Common Cause Oregon. Common Cause supports continuous web-based electronic filing and searchable database of campaign finance data. We have testified before this committee in support of Senate Bill 160, a comprehensive campaign finance disclosure bill. While the primary goal of Senate Bill 606 is to require weekly electronic filing, a concept we support, we do not support deleting the requirement that occupation of contributor be reported. As part of our research as a member of the Secretary of State's Campaign Finance Disclosure Panel, we studied the Campaign Finance Disclosure Model Law from the Campaign Finance Disclosure Project. I've referenced this document before in this committee. The Model Law is accompanied by a list of the 10 most important disclosure provisions that should be incorporated into any disclosure law. The first listed of these provisions is mandatory occupation and employer information for contributors. And then I've put in a piece of that manual so you don't have to download the whole thing that talks about why we need to have occupation. In 160, I believe we have only occupation and not employer. I would prefer, as Common Cause would prefer, occupation and employer. We have great regard for the folks that did the model law. So we urge you to support the inclusion of occupation and employer information in any campaign finance disclosure legislation you consider, and that's why we are here in opposition to 606.
Great. Thank you.
Questions?
Madam Chairman, I just wondered if the folks from Common Cause had had an opportunity to discuss their opposition on this technical point with the proponents of the bill.
Excuse me?
Has anybody suggested the amendment of the bill? to deal with their concern.
Actually, Chair Brown, Senator Ferrioli, we were so strongly in support of Senate Bill 160 that it's our primary goal to have a bill like that pass this session. This bill has too many other problems, and I didn't think it was worth anyone's time to amend a problematic bill when we have before us several bills that Common Cause felt were better.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Miller. That will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 606 and open. Oops, I'm going to. Anybody else in the audience wishing to testify on Senate Bill 606? Okay. Close the public hearing on 606. Reopen a public hearing on Senate Joint Resolution 7 and invite Ms. Kathy Eaton to come forward.
Good morning, Ms. Eaton.
Good morning, Madam Chair, Senator Ferrioli. Thank you for reopening it for some very brief remarks on my part. I was very much interested in the conversation that the committee had with Senators Johnson and Morris, because this whole issue of the public knowing what the impacts of an initiative are is a very real and important issue to the members of the League. In the last 15 years, we have revisited the initiative process three times to update our information and to see if we could add to the public knowledge about the whole initiative process. We very much support direct democracy, but in the changes that we would recommend, looking at the indirect initiative, which is what's proposed here, is one of the things that we think merits full discussion, because in the process of getting the signatures, as we all know, you're asked to sign a petition. Very little information is available. Even though the text is there, people are trying to get the signatures, and they really say, "That's, you know, this is what it's about." And people don't ask questions very much anymore. So when then you get to the campaign, and it's very much less objective, because you have people trying to get it passed or people trying to get it rejected. So we have felt that there should be in place some way in which to increase the public discourse. SJR 7 presents one of those possibilities where you bring it before the legislature to have hearings and in the advisory comments. Now, there are several states that have there are 26 states that have the initiative, and several of the states do have the indirect initiative process. What's different about our state and those states is that they all have annual sessions, so that the ability to bring an initiative almost immediately is possible. We don't have that. However, in the modification of when you would file an initiative and then have it go to the legislature, hopefully with those initiatives being the first bills to be heard, that's a possibility, and you could move it forward. We see that really as the major block, perhaps, to this kind of discourse. But, however, we do hope that the committee will take a look at some of the other kinds of ways in which there could be public discourse that have been brought forward. Senate Bill 201 is one, for instance, and there are others that have been proposed in the past where somehow there is the ability for the public to have an opportunity to testify, to hear, to discuss the impact of an initiative before the vote is taken. We hope that you will, in fact, have a discussion about that, and we would be happy to participate in that. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Questions, Senator Ferrioli?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Ms. Eaton, you mentioned that the group has done a report, and I would be very interested in receiving the League of Women Voters study on direct democracy if you have something like
that. Well, Senator Farioli, what we did was a study on the initiative process itself. Mm-hmm. We certainly can provide that to you. And there is, within that report, we reached some consensus and adopted some positions that have some recommendations for looking at changes in the initiative process, the indirect initiative being part of that. I would be happy to provide that for you.
I would enjoy reading that. Madam Chairman, just an observation. I think it's valuable to understand that all of the other states that have an indirect process have annual sessions. I will share a fear. And that is that in trying to increase participation in direct democracy and in other participatory forms, access, accessibility, and simplicity are features that either really help people engage. And in the absence of access or simplicity or accessibility, it really causes people to disengage from the political process. And that harms all of us. But my fear is that there seems to be a concerted move to make the initiative process less accessible, less simple, and less user-friendly by those who don't like the outcomes. And I just wondered if the folks from the League have discussed or have been aware of the sort of shift in public attitudes toward the initiative process, and whether they're aware of any sort of concerted effort to make the initiative process maybe less accessible to people because they don't like the outcomes.
Senator Brown, Senator Farioli, in our discussions, we really weren't as interested in whether or not you had a preconceived idea whether initiative was good or bad. We really wanted to see that the initiative process could be improved, because we really believe that there is there should be an opportunity for the public, if the issue that they're interested in has not been addressed by the legislative process, a way in which to do that. But we wanted to make that as clear and clean and objective and as open a process as possible, without any preconceived ideas whether we liked this one or we didn't like that one.
Madam Chairman, I really appreciate this testimony. I'll be looking forward to receiving the report on the initiative process. And I would just urge people to be aware, just urge Oregonians to be aware, there are folks that want to raise the bar on qualifying initiatives and in the participation of direct democracy. I'm very interested in improving the process and making it more transparent and more user-friendly and increasing its accessibility. But I believe that there are those in Oregon that want to do just the opposite and make initiative processes far more difficult for citizens to engage in. And that's an issue, that's a public issue that we ought to publicly debate. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Farioli. Thank you, Ms. Eaton. We appreciate you being here. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on SJR 7. And Oregon Episcopal students, come on forward. They're like, what are we? Come on, you guys. Don't be shy.
This is an exercise in participation.
Yes, it is.
Here to present SJR number 3.
Are you serious?
No.
No, okay. Why don't you have a seat?
Okay.
Right up here so we can see you. A couple people want to sit up here. The dais. Anybody want to sit at the dais? Oh, come on. There we go. Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm going to open a public hearing on SCR 3, and we're going to have the committee administrator tell us a little about that, and then we'll have you guys introduce yourselves, and we'll have a conversation about what we do here. Okay?
Yes.
Go ahead.
Thanks, Madam Chair. SCR 3 would establish a sister state relationship with the Kurdistan regional government. It also proposes the appointment of a sister state committee to promote cultural, economic, and political relations between Oregon and Kurdistan.
Okay, you three, could you please state your names for the record?
My name for the record is Jacob Reisberg.
Hi, Jacob. Welcome.
My name is Sergio Zenisek.
Sergio, welcome.
My name is Tali Singer.
Hi, welcome. And what grade are you all in?
I'm a junior. Junior.
Freshman.
Oh, okay. All right. We're going to let Senator Atkinson testify on the bill, and then we'll have it, we'll open it up for conversation there. Or if you guys want to ask him any questions, you can. Senator Atkinson, tell us about this resolution.
Would you like to testify here or down there?
It's up to you.
What would you prefer, ma'am?
It's up to you. You're welcome to stay here if you would like.
Thank you. First of all, Madam Chairman, see, I stopped, Madam Chair. My apologies to you. We had a 7 a.m. hearing this morning for environment and land use, and my internal clock that is only set for 4 hours of testimony forgot that in lieu of the fact that I have business at 1, that I also had rules today, and this will be 6 hours, and so I apologize. I went diligently back to my office to work, and so I apologize for
we hope you got
getting
a much
so
needed nap, Senator
late.
Atkinson.
Anyway, so I apologize for my delay. Let me tell you about S. For the record, my name's Jason Atkinson. I'm a senator from Southern Oregon. Let me tell you a little bit about SCR 3. This has been a very long-standing interest of mine, and this particular bill is very timely simply because of what's going on right now in Iraq. What this bill seeks to do is to create a relationship between Oregon and the northern portion of Iraq to develop a sister state type of relationship. We currently have this relationship. There's various cities that have this relationship with other cities around the world. But we also have this relationship between the state of Oregon and China, actually a province of China. So that was really the backdrop. And really what happens is that when these things are created, you have cultural exchanges, and you also benefit economically from the relationships that are made. My interest in this, though, Madam Chair, is that I am fourth generation of a family with that comes from Assyria, which Assyria is no longer a country. It was supposed to be a country after World War I, but in the redrawing of the map, Assyria was never redrawn. And right before World War I, when the Turks came down to invade that portion of what is now Syria, my great-grandfather escaped and came here, and last year his great-grandson sat down with the King of Jordan as an American politician. So it's all kind of full circle. So my interest in that, in the region, is both historically and also I think it's good public policy, because Kurdistan is also part of that area. Kurdistan and northern Iraq would also be what would be, if you redrew the map, modern-day Syria. And my family has had relatives that, interestingly enough, were carpet dealers in Baghdad at one time, or so the family lore goes. Kurdistan, as you recall, was an area that has a difference from the Ba'ath Party members in southern Iraq, and was a place where Saddam Hussein chemically tortured people, and their communities were the recipient of his wrath. Kurdistan today, though, is actually a place where there's a tremendous amount of peace, and the governing body there has really separated itself from the rest of Iraq in terms of police, education, public education, but also public processes like water, sewer, and things like that. And they are on a huge outreach right now to create relationships around the globe to do two things. Number one, promote them and promote what they can do for the rest of the world economically, but also to really get young people in our country to invest in young people in their country, not only to understand their culture and their religion, but also where in the world this is. So it's with that, Madam Chair, even belated and slightly delayed, that I bring this to you, and I think it's a good bill, and if we're able to do it, I was actually already invited to go watch the election in February, but Mrs. Atkinson didn't think that was as good of an idea as her adventurous husband. but I will be hopefully visiting the region at some point in my life. I think it'd be great.
Well, thank you for that very interesting geopolitical lesson. Do any of our students wish to testify?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair.
They do?
Come on.
No, thank you.
Okay, you sure? Sergio, no? Okay.
Do you have any questions?
Do you have any questions for Senator Atkinson?
So how many sister state relationships can go on at one time?
As many as we want. Really what it is, some of these things are more formality than substance, but some of them really, some people really work hard on the relationship. I know with the province of China that we have a sister state relationship with. It's been very beneficial, and there's groups of people working in China to promote Oregon products and people in Oregon working to promote Chinese products. I will also tell you, though, that as soon as we set that up, the ROC, the Republic of China, which is also known as Taiwan, which is not under China's control, immediately tried to set up one also. And they go very much offensively to set up relationships with states, countries, because they're afraid if China ever invades them, they want to have as much economic ties as they can to the states. And so Oregon actually has an office in Taipei, and so does Iowa, and so does Idaho, and all these other states. So we have a little bit different of a relationship with them, but we do have a relationship. It can be as many, it really is up to the states to see how successful it can be and why you would do it. So are we going to have huge economic benefit from having a relationship with Kurdistan? That's the next question. And the answer is immediately, probably not. However, they are asking for Oregon products such as concrete, timber, and food. So maybe. That's a long way around. But
sometimes these are done for economic reasons. Other times just for general purposes. I know that the city of Portland has a number of sister cities. We just established sister city recently with the city of Bologna in Italy. So it really depends upon the jurisdictions and the purpose. So other questions for the senators? You guys are shy. Go ahead.
What are some of the other benefits of having a sister state?
Okay. Well, that's good, too. Sometimes when you have a sister state relationship, sometimes there's, you know, one of the things you're trying to promote is travel back and forth, and sometimes there's travel benefits. Sometimes there's youth programs, mm-hmm. which I would humbly volunteer if the good Senator Brown would like to take me to Italy. those are some of the benefits. I think long-term, though, that it's something that's less tangible. And what the less tangible, harder to put your handprint on is relationships you build with people. Where I went to undergraduate school has a sister relationship with another campus in Mexico and a campus in Japan. And they've had those relationships now for 27 and 28 years, respectively. And well, what has that done? Well, they've actually had huge transfers of programs, educational transfers, and now we've got all these students from three different organizations that have married each other and created students of their own. And so culturally I think over time what I've learned in politics is it's really about people and not necessarily about politics. I mean, all of us here, we're different parties in different regions, but we're all pretty good friends, and all of us aren't going to serve here forever. So the more relationships you have with people across the world, I think, does a lot of good.
We had a question in back, and you're going to need to come to the mic. You must be the teacher. Okay. Thanks for letting me use your students as guinea pigs this morning. Yeah, it'll work.
Does it cost anything to the state to have this
relationship?
Very good.
Very good question.
If so, where does the revenue come from? And secondly, how does a concurrent resolution work? Does that have to go over to this House after it's passed by the Senate, and then to the governor, or what?
And we need your name for the record.
Chris Myers, M-Y-E-R-S.
Thank you, Mr. Myers.
Mr. Atkinson.
There is no fiscal impact on this other than the cost of printing, and that's not trivial. But there's no cost to the state that I know of for doing creating a sister type of relationship. A concurrent resolution, we have several different forms that we can pass. We can pass a bill, which is what most people know of. A bill actually goes through the entire process and to the governor. We can pass a concurrent resolution, which will go, does not go to the executive. It's just both houses acting concurrently or together. We can have a memorial, which we passed this morning in another committee that I was sitting in that chair for. And a joint memorial also does not go to the governor. It goes directly to Congress. And then the other type that we can pass is a referral to the people, which is a legislative branch of government asking the people of the state of Oregon to make a decision. That also does not go to the governor.
All right. Any other questions? Go ahead. In the pink shirt, come on up. And you have to state your name for the record.
My name is Paul Choi. I have a question that may seem really stupid.
That's okay. I shouldn't say we're used to stupid questions, but we take all questions here. We can't always answer them, but we certainly try.
Okay. Don't you think people with prejudices against Iraqi people, like Middle Eastern people, would object to this relationship between Oregon and Kurdistan?
You want to respond to that?
Sure. That's a good point. That's actually a very, very good point, and I think part of the reason why you have to do stuff like this. I think there was people who have prejudice on a whole variety of issues that shouldn't really not stop the legislature from acting. Prejudice really is, I think, and we all would agree, is in the eye of the beholder. But I think if you also look, we're now at 2005. I think if you were at 1965, Americans would look at issues around prejudice a lot differently than they do today. Today, our country's actually come a very, very long way. And it's slowly. I mean, it's slow and incremental. I mean, I wasn't born in 1965. My two colleagues were. But you know, I think it's a very good topic. But I think this would hopefully, there would be some people who would probably oppose it. But I think over time, getting at prejudice is exactly why we do things like this, because it would essentially be between what's largely thought of as a Judeo-Christian country with what is largely thought of as a fundamentalist Muslim area.
Okay. Senator Farrelly, and then I know we had one more question. Oh, we got two more. Okay.
Just to try to answer the issue, and I think it's an excellent question. Prejudice is related to fear and anger. And interestingly, we often see a difference between the politics that are conducted at the international or the national level and the regional level and the local level. You can have different political wills being expressed simultaneously at different levels. There's an expression that we've heard a lot about politics, and that is that all politics is local. Let me suggest to you that whether it's international, national, regional, local, all politics really is personal. It's your personal expression of belief. And I think Senator Atkinson expressed it very well when he said that some of the best politics are person to person. And I think that our chair explained also that having these relationships give people an opportunity to explore the personal relationships. And in doing those things, fear dissipates and trust builds. And that, I believe, is probably the best reason to do sister relationships, either at the sister state or sister city or sister community level. Those relationships build understanding, and understanding dissipates fear. And I think that's probably the reason to do these things.
Talia, did you have a question?
Yeah.
Can you pull the mic down? That's great.
How do you decide who we have a sister relationship with?
Another great question. I just thought it up. It's just like, how does any bill become a law? You could contact me and say, you know what, Senator Atkinson, I got a great idea. Why don't we do this. Or Senator Brown might just be woken up in the middle of the night and think of a bright idea and write down a piece of paper and then get up at 6 in the morning and go, you know what, that was really smart. I think I'll make it a law. There's any number of ways that an idea can become a law or something like this could be chosen. This idea came to me through a connection I've made overseas, and it led to another person who led to another person who led to this guy in Tennessee who led to the Kurdistan Economic Development Department, which led to me floating around a few ideas with some senators, and they didn't meet it with laughter. They said, you know what, that might be a good idea, and off we went. So how it got chosen or how we choose sister states relationships, there's no single way to do it, just like there's no single way to pass a bill.
Anybody know what the state beverage is of the state of Oregon? Anybody have a guess? No, it's not beer. It's milk.
Mm.
And you know why we have an official designation of state beverage? It's because some Tillamook students wanted, and do you know where we grow a lot of milk? Obviously, grow a lot of cows and make a lot of milk. In Tillamook. It's cow country. And so Tillamook students said, we want milk to be the official beverage. They contacted their state senator. She introduced the bill, and now milk is the official beverage of the state of Oregon. So, Jacob, you had a question, and then I think your teacher, you got to go. Okay.
Actually, I have two really brief questions. No worries, Chris. One, would there have to be, in Kurdistan, would anyone have to pass a bill saying basically the same thing at their end, that they'd like to establish a sister state with Oregon?
No, but some kind of formality on their end would help.
Okay, and then secondly, I wonder whether or not Oregon is already a sister state with any other regional governments in Iraq in particular, and if not, whether any potential tensions could arise because we are becoming a sister state with one of the regional governments and not the other.
Very good question. To my knowledge, the first part of your second question is no.
Okay.
We do not, to my knowledge, have a sister relationship with any other a portion of Iraq, and your other part, I kind of doubt it. And the reason I say that is if we're successful, I would see that various areas would probably want relationships like Kurdistan is asking for with the Oregon or any other state. I really don't think that people in Baghdad are as focused on economic development and these kind of relationships as Kurdistan. So I really don't think so, but I could be wrong, but I don't think so.
Thank you.
Okay. But that's a good question.
Do all three of you think we should pass this?
Yes, ma'am. Yes.
Okay, everybody in back think we should pass this? Okay, let's move into work session. Senator Atkinson.
Madam Chair, I would ask that we move SCR 3 to the floor. Do adopt recommendation.
Senator Atkinson has moved SCR 3 to the Senate floor with the do adopt recommendation. Would you please call the roll?
Senator Atkinson?
Yes.
Senator Rico?
Excused.
Senator Shields?
Excused.
Vice Chair Ferrioli?
Aye.
Chair Brown.
Chair votes aye. Measure passes. And Senator Atkinson, would you please carry it for us on the Senate floor? And seeing as there's no other business to come before the committee, we're going to adjourn. Thank you very much. Thank you for your cooperation, colleagues.